From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The coronavirus surge is coming, plus an election fiasco potentially in Wisconsin. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. Sitting in today for Paul Jagot, we are joined by my colleagues Kim Strassel. Hello, Kim.
Hi there.
And Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
At President Trump's virus briefing Monday night, he said that, quote, the next week and a half is going to be a big surge. Over the weekend, the Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, said that, quote, this is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment, our 9/11 moment, only it's not going to be localized. It's going to be happening all over the country. That is a very stark warning, Kim. What should Americans be prepared to see?
Well, in some ways, we've been preparing for this for a while. If you look out there at the modeling, it has long suggested that we were going to hit a peak moment. And for many states, in particular, the hot spots out there of New York and New Jersey, other places, this is the week. And so we're going to be seeing a lot of deaths, a lot of greater hospital admissions. On the other hand, I think that there is some good news out there too, which is that if you look at a lot of states and those outside of hotspots, some of the modeling and predictions have not necessarily materialized in the grave forms that were first estimated. And the other good news in theory is that if we get past this peak, things should start to improve.
Yeah, President Trump is also saying that there's light at the end of the tunnel. Governor Andrew Cuomo said Monday that he sees a possible flattening of the curve in his state. And there's been a real surge in resources, it seems, too. So the Navy hospital ship Comfort is there in New York with 1,000 beds, and it's going to start taking coronavirus patients, according to President Trump. And then also some redeployment of ventilators. California sending 500 to the national stockpile. Oregon sending 140 to New York. Washington State, where the first real virus outbreak was, sending 400 ventilators back to the national stockpile. Bill, that seems to be a very good effort here.
It is a good effort, but I think we have to point out that the numbers, the models have been projecting different things. In the end, because of our lack of testing, all these models are at best educated guesses. Tomorrow is the day. Wednesday is the day that New York hits its peak demand for hospital resources, such as beds and hospitals. And if you remember, just about 10 days ago, Governor Cuomo was complaining to President Trump, say, you pick the 26,000 people who will die if you don't give me the 37,000 ventilators that I need. Well, now we're looking at the numbers. And it turns out, again, tomorrow is the peak demand. And it's only going to be about 5,000 or so ventilators that are need 5,500, 5,700, let me see what they're projecting, 5,700 on the peak. 5,700 is very different from 37,000. So, and then the next day is for deaths, daily deaths, which has been climbing on the curve. But if both these things actually do turn out to be a peak, I think it might help turn the conversation to be the first real evidence in the United States that we've turned any kind of corner. We're not by no means out of the woods, because even if deaths start to go down, they're still going to be high for a while. But I think that that might help turn the corner on the conversations about how we get our nation and our states back to work, not just, you know, when we can do it and when the worst is going to hit.
A very hopeful quote from the Monday briefing, to your point, that I'll pull out is from Brett Jirwa, the Assistant Secretary for Health, who said that no one has not gotten a ventilator that needs a ventilator. And as far as we can project looking at all models, every person that needs a ventilator will get a ventilator. Bill, do we know yet? I know we're still in the middle of this, but do we know yet why the actual demand seems to be different from what Governor Cuomo was saying just a, you know, days or weeks ago?
Well, it depends on your model. And the problem with all our models is we really don't have a good idea of how many people are infected. You know, one doctor out at Stanford, epidemiologist, was saying it could be 50 times the number that we think, which in some ways would be a good thing, because it would mean, one, that the fatality rate is a lot lower than we now think. And it could also mean we're closer to granting the herd immunity, which occurs when enough people have had the virus that it becomes harder for the virus to find people who haven't had it to infect. And so you kind of get immune that way. So, I mean, I don't think we want to blame anyone with the modeling. The modeling is only good as the assumptions. And until we have a lot more testing, we're going to still be doing a lot of guesses. And I think that the priority has to be testing so we can find out who's not infected, who is infected and is a threat, and who has been infected and is now immune, because we need to treat these people all very differently.
And on that point, there's some good news, too. So the Food and Drug Administration just recently gave its authorization to the first of these blood tests to test for the antibodies to see potentially who is immune. And Brett Giroir, again, the Assistant Health Secretary, said on Monday that they expect, if things work out the way they expect they will, that they will have millions of these tests on the market by May. And that's the way that America can get sort of back to opening up again. Kim, I mean, the Trump administration has been criticized for being slow off the mark on the initial round of testing. I mean, is this a place that they can really take control of the crisis again?
Yeah, and this is where they should be putting all of their efforts, right? I mean, people are focused very much on social distancing guidelines and what, you know, the daily briefings. The most important, in my mind, the most important thing that the federal government can be doing, because they're in a rare position to both coordinate something like this and also to quality control something like this, is a rapid, massive testing regime. And, you know, as hopeful as that number was, I hope that there's going to be 10 times that many by May. That would mean they have done a good job, because this is the only way, in my mind, to get a handle on this virus. Bill was just talking about the unknown here and why so many of these models are off. And that's, of course, because a lot of these models have been making assumptions about, you know, what percentage of people who get this disease are going to end up in a hospital. And those percentages in the models have been quite high. But if the disease is far more widespread than we thought, those predictions go down, and it seems to suggest maybe that that's one reason why those models are a bit off. We don't even still have good data out of places like Italy or Spain or any of the countries that dealt with this first. And so you have to deploy these tests, and you have to get a grip on what that denominator is, and then also have the ability to rapidly test and deal with any kind of people who continue to come down with it, so that you can trace and you can isolate and you can contain any further breakouts. And one other thing that I think was encouraging listening to Mr. Giroir is that they're also working very hard to make sure that there's a quality control aspect to this. They're working to validate a lot of these antibody tests that are now flooding onto the market, because what you also don't want is some situation where you're having very high amounts of false negatives or false positives. That undermines the entire point of the exercise.
Looking a little bit farther out, the vaccine is the answer that health authorities keep saying that we will be eventually waiting for. And the trouble there is it's a really long process, going through stages of review and then ramping up to manufacture it. But some good news there. Bill Gates is saying that his foundation will put billions of dollars into this process. And he's saying that they'll pick the 7 vaccines and fund factories for them all. And even if only 2 of those pan out and he wastes a lot of money, that's the way to get this going as fast as possible. So, Bill, you know, thank goodness for the Gates Foundation.
Absolutely. And the private sector, because I think it shows it's able to be more nimble than the government in responding and make those kind of bets. Especially the Gates Foundation is a nonprofit, so it can spend that money, and I think it can harness the experts and the infrastructure they need to do it. Whether it will succeed, I don't know, but we have lots of similar efforts all around the world, and I think that's why we can respond much more quickly than most.
We're talking about the coronavirus surge, elections in Wisconsin, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene.
As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Kyle Peterson here with my colleagues Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. Kim, there does seem to be a coming together of minds on what a phase four coronavirus relief bill might look like. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is saying that there's going to be some sort of extra targeted response. Nancy Pelosi has backed off of her idea for a massive stimulus package a little bit and is saying maybe just more money for states and businesses and direct payments. The quote from her on Friday was, "Let's do the same bill we just did, make some changes and make it current." Joe Biden is saying that we're going to need at least two more iterations of it to help the economy. Kim, what's your sense of the state of play on Capitol Hill?
Well, the urgency right now, as just sort of talked about recently by Mitch McConnell, is funding for that small business loan program, increased funding for it. Because what we saw happen was, as the government opened its doors to people to tap that money for small businesses, they ran through it within like a day. We are getting reports back of banks that had said they were already saying to customers it was first come, first serve, and sorry, we've already tapped resources. So Mitch McConnell's aim, he said, is this week, and he just put out a statement saying that he wanted to secure more funds for that type of federal assistance, and that he hopes to do this quickly this week and through unanimous consent or a voice vote so that everyone doesn't have to come back necessarily. Now, we will see what Democrats' response is to that. You know, the last time we did this, their goal was to throw a lot more money into a lot of different pots. But I think the argument Republicans can make and should make is that we're not necessarily seeing the demand yet in other quarters, that we should wait and see how that aid is working out in terms of unemployment insurance, in terms of loans to bigger corporations, and in terms of the checks that we sent out to people before we go adding to those as well, too.
And then one last thing on the coronavirus. Let's talk briefly about Captain Brett Crozier, who was relieved of his command of the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt last week after he sent a letter warning about coronavirus on his ship that leaked to the media. Then on Monday morning, the acting Navy Secretary, Thomas Modley, told the ship's crew, apparently over the intercom there, that Captain Crozier had committed a betrayal and was naive and said he maybe is too stupid. That speech, of course, then leaked to the media, and this Navy Secretary has apologized. Bill, how do you sort out that mess?
I don't think it's anywhere near being sorted out now. I have to say, I understand his plight, you know, as head of the ship. But my instinct is just it's a very bad thing when people break the chain of command, you know, no matter what the circumstances. And, you know, people can be good and sound and make bad decisions in the crisis. People are, you know, in the military are often relieved of command in the middle of a battle because they've done something wrong. So I thought Trump had actually, ironically, the most modest take. There might be two people. His Navy secretary and Mr. Crozier, who had a moment or a bad day showing bad judgment, and he doesn't want to see, you know, their lives ruined for it. You know, I thought that was a modest take so far. But I don't think you can have anything that justifies the kind of behavior where you go past the chain of command and you make something public like that. I think that's really dangerous. And I think a man of his rank ought to know that.
All right. And then amid the pandemic, Wisconsin is holding elections today, Tuesday, including for a state on the Supreme Court or a seat on the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, as well as its presidential primaries. There are fewer polling places open than usual. The National Guard has been called in to help staff them. But there's reports of long lines already, and people are worried about turnout. And it's created a bit of a legal pileup. Kim, can you explain what has happened here?
Yeah, well, what you ended up having was the governor of Wisconsin, Tony Evers, who is a Democrat, ordered the postponement of and the extension of the deadline for mail ballots until June 9th. And there was court action taken. The Wisconsin Supreme Court stepped in and said no. On a somewhat different track, the U.S. Supreme Court also struck down a court order that would have extended the period to return absentee ballots in the primary election. What you have now are liberals all over the country crying foul and saying that these are incredibly political decisions by the courts designed to disenfranchise certain voters out there. I think that perhaps the better way to look at it, and you can argue over what needed or should have been done given the virus and what to do to accommodate this, but historically, courts at all levels have been very loath to make last-minute changes to elections or anything that sort of upends election procedures. So I guess these orders are sort of somewhat more in keeping with courts, although you could have a discussion about whether or not something different was or is needed given the virus problem.
Yeah, I mean, my read of this, I guess, is that they state leaders were taken a little bit by surprise, because even in mid-March, Governor Evers was saying that they weren't going to postpone. There's an AP story with the date on it of March 25th, and the lead of the story is that local officials were mad with Governor Evers because he had refused so far, refusal is the word there, to make any changes to the presidential primary. And then by the time they figured out that the virus was going to hit worse than they expected, it was a little bit late. So Governor Evers at one point suggested sending every registered voter, not just voters who'd requested an absentee ballot, but every registered voter sending an absentee ballot. The state legislature was saying that there wasn't time for that, given the short time frame to get all those printed and mailed out. And then you had a federal judge say, extend that date for people to mail their absentee ballots past Election Day, and then tell the state that they could not report results of the election, because then that could potentially bias people who had not sent their ballots in yet. I mean, Bill, for all the criticism that the U.S. Supreme Court is getting, I mean, is this just a matter of policing the divisions of government, policing federalism a little bit?
I think that's a chief responsibility of the Supreme Court, and one that it's ignored for a long time until recent years. So yes, I'd agree. And that's I think, as Kim was making the point in Wisconsin, it's not just what outcome we want, it's who gets to decide this. And I think what we want, our system puts most of these decisions on legislatures because they can help be held accountable. For example, if Wisconsin really stuffs it up with this election, you can vote the legislators out and they'll respond to it. If it's the court making the decision, not much you can do. You're stuck with it. So yes, I think the Supreme Court's job is to sort out the federalism, because I think the separated powers are really the key to our freedom and keeping them separate.
So far, about 15 states, at least 15 states, have pushed back their presidential primaries, which leaves Joe Biden, who is the candidate in the lead, but he hasn't secured a majority of delegates yet. I mean, that leaves him in a little bit of limbo. But Kim, does it change anything? Does it open up the race at all? I mean, Andrew Cuomo now, people are being impressed with his response to the coronavirus. He's having to deny that he has any interest in jumping in or anything like that. I mean, does it change anything fundamentally about where the race stands?
I'd say no. In that, look, I still maintain that politically one of the biggest beneficiaries of this virus, if you can say it that way, was Joe Biden, given that its emergence as the dominating theme came at a moment in which, you know, Bernie Sanders was down but not out. And but it also came at a time when Joe Biden had kind of consolidated his support and was viewed by many people as a front runner. Bernie Sanders has had almost no opportunity to break through all the headlines. Even Joe Biden has struggled to break through the headlines. But what it does is sort of solidified the race where it was. And that means Joe Biden's ahead. And I would wager in upcoming election battles, you'll see that the primaries that do take place, you'll see that reflected in the polls. And he'll slowly continue to rack up his delegates. And at some point, you know, the gravity of the situation will presumably hit Bernie Sanders and he'll drop out.
And what about that, Bill? I mean, what is Bernie doing so far? He has said that there's still a narrow window for him to the nomination. He has defended the right of his backers to vote for him in states that haven't gone yet. But there are some reports now that even some of his top aides, including his campaign manager, are urging him to drop out and saying that he would have more leverage that way than if he tried to ride his campaign all the way to the convention. I mean, if you're in Bernie Sanders' shoes or if you're advising him, I mean, what do you tell him to do at this point in this really unique situation?
Well, it depends what they want. If the if Bernie Sanders really wants the defeat of Donald Trump, I think he would get out of the race and support Joe Biden. If he wants his agenda, which I think is more likely because he's very committed to it. I disagree with like every aspect of it, but I think there's no doubt that Bernie believes that. I think his leverage is now, before he drops out, to get something in exchange. He wouldn't get everything. For example, you know, with all the unemployment claims, I noticed there's a new push for Medicare for All, saying what happens, you know, when you lose your employer based insurance because you lose your employment. So, I mean, I think there are answers to that, but I think it gives, you know, Bernie a little more life to push his Medicare for All. It'd be interesting to see how Joe Biden responds to that. But, I mean, Bernie Sanders isn't really a Democrat, you know, so I'm not sure he really cares so much about the party. He cares vehemently about his agenda, and I think that's going to tell. And I think he's setting the party up, not necessarily to be a spoiler, but to split. He's setting it up for a lot of resentment on his supporters that for some reason or another, he didn't get his due. And I think that's why all the other people who want to defeat Donald Trump are urging him to drop out.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. But thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. And we'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.